Mikey Pod. Hello, welcome to Mikey Pod on the Bayou. This is episode 40, and today is March 17th, 2006. It's late, well, late-ish. It's 6:53. I have a poker game to attend at 8 o'clock, so I may not actually post the show till later, but I like to record it when nobody's home. So that's what I'm doing. Today I have the second half of the interview with Kathy Kelly. By the way, there are some new listeners, some new subscribers over the past month, and I keep forgetting to tell you guys welcome and thank you for subscribing and for listening to the show. I always love to hear feedback. If you have it, you can email me at mikeypod@gmail.com. And you can always comment on the website at www.mikeypod.com. And there's a voicemail number, which I need to commit to memory or at least tape to my monitor or something so I can give it to you every time. But I do always put it in the tags so you can look at your iPod or whatever MP3 player or at your computer screen and see the voicemail number. I got some great feedback this week, and I'll share it with you on my next show, which will also feature an interview with the guy who you're about to hear singing. David Rovix has agreed to be interviewed, and I'll be doing that interview this Sunday and putting the show together by like Tuesday or so. Anyway, I'm talking too much, so please enjoy this song. It's called "Who Would Jesus Bomb" by David Rovix, and of course that will be followed by the interview with Kathy Kelly, and I'll go right into the interview. Okay, enjoy.
I've seen you in the markets, I've seen you in the streets, and at your political conventions. Talking of your crusade, talking of your nation, and other things too terrible to mention. And you proclaim your Christianity, you proclaim your love of God, you talk of apple pie and mine. I just got one question, and I want an answer. Tell me, who would Jesus bomb? Maybe Jesus would bomb the Syrians, cause they're not Jews like him. Maybe Jesus would bomb the Afghans on some kind of vengeful whim. Maybe Jesus would drive an M1 tank and he would shoot Saddam. Who would Jesus bomb? Yes, I've seen you on the TV and on the battleships. I've seen you in the house on the hill. And I've heard you talking about making the world safer and about all the men you have to kill. And you speak so glibly about your civilization and how you have the moral higher ground. While halfway around the world, your explosives smash the buildings. If you could only hear the sound. But maybe Jesus would sell landmines and turn on his electric chair. Maybe Jesus would show no compassion for his enemies in the lands way over there. Maybe Jesus would have flown the planes that killed the kids in Vietnam. Who would Jesus bomb? Yes, I hear you shout with confidence as you praise the Lord and you talk about this God you know so well. You talk of Armageddon and your final victory when all the evil forces go to hell. Well, you'd best hope you've chosen wisely on the right side of the Lord, and when you die, your conscience, it is clear. You'd best hope your atom bombs are better than the sword, and the time when your reckoning is here. Cause I don't think Jesus would send gunships into Bethlehem or jets to raise the towns of Timorese. I don't think Jesus would lend money to dictators or drive those SUVs. I don't think Jesus would ever have dropped a single ounce of napalm. Who would Jesus bomb? Jesus fine. Who would Jesus find?
Okay, I'm back with Kathy Kelly after being cut off for the second time. Thank you for your patience.
Surely.
So we were you were talking about people being able to find ways to take control of their lives.
Well, right, but I think that one thing that it's very difficult to look at because it is so threatening is the fact that it seems that on our planet the peak of discovery of oil has already been passed. Scientists are saying that they're not expecting to find some new reserve of oil in the world. So that means what has been discovered is what's available. Because oil is not a replaceable resource, you know, it's not like somehow you can expect that you keep on using up what's there and it replaces itself. It's a precious and an irreplaceable resource. And the fossil fuels available to us are all that will be available to the next generation and the next generation and the next. And so if there's only a certain pool that's available, I mean, if you were to imagine a certain pool of water and you use it up and it runs dry, well, that's it. And so it would suggest that we should be doing everything we can now to figure out how to change our lives so that we wouldn't consume as much oil as we do, so that we'll leave some for the next generations. Because in an industrialized society, it's very, very difficult to move away from what we've grown very accustomed to with oil-based, petroleum-based sciences and productions. And it's not just the oil that we use in gas tanks. So this petroleum has become important in many, many, many different industries. And so, you know, just thinking about eating your breakfast in the morning, a lot of times those products that we're so accustomed to having, coffee or cereals or bananas, they come from other parts of the world. They're sometimes flown here, sometimes trucked into various cities and refrigerated and sold. Well, this whole concept of automatically having whatever we want at our fingertips probably isn't going to persist into next generations. And if we were to avoid a crash landing when all of a sudden the oil prices would spike so high, because even the oil producers would say, look, you know, we're not going to be able to turn a profit with the extra finance that's required to get this oil out of the ground, so the prices might shoot up. Well, if we're to avoid a crash landing, then it would make sense to start trying to experiment with changing our lifestyles. And I don't think we can look to the president or to the elected representatives or apparently to the church leadership or religious leadership or to the university people. I think we really have to look to one another and say, well, where are the communities that are learning how to live simply and share their resources? Now, in big cities, I can tell you, find the nearest Catholic worker house. For decades now, people have been learning to live simply, share their resources, share their income, accept people who are homeless or needy as their companions in living situations, and many of them are sworn pacifists, and they don't take any money from the government, they don't give any money to the government, and they have very, very productive and thriving communities, and you'll see some of the happiest people in the world over in those communities. Look for the seediest area near you, and you're very likely to find one of these Catholic worker houses or another volunteer community. I mean, people get to know one another, and they form bonds, and they look out for one another. And I can tell you, the grass doesn't look greener elsewhere to me.
Right. There are things like that I'm discovering here in Houston too. I've been working with a food co-op that really does a lot with locally grown organic vegetables, and they try to supply to the community people who can't afford this food. Discovering those sort of things are really what start to give me hope about the possibility of change in our country.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that. Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the role that spirituality plays in the way you live your life and how you're able to take such risks toward what you believe in.
But somebody on my mind very much recently is a man named Franz Jägerstätter, and he was a peasant. He was a farmer in the village of Radegund in Austria. And as conscription was widening for people to join Hitler's armies, he just flat out said to the military people, why would I follow this man Hitler when I could follow my King Jesus? And it was a, sort of an easy, clear choice for Franz Jägerstätter. And so his relatives were rushed in. You know, he talks sense to Franz. He's got children. He has a wife. They brought the bishop in to reason with him. People were indignant. You know, how could Franz be so bullheaded? And he thought, well, this is my core set of values and principles. How could I not live in accord with them? And he adamantly would not join up into Hitler's army. You know, I don't believe that the values I have are unusual, or that this, you know, the spirit that, that seems to stir me and a lot of the people I most admire is one that's exclusive. It's something that we've all been taught since we were children, many of us in this country. I mean, one thing maybe a bit exceptional about me, but I know I share it with many, is that I grew up in a neighborhood where really the only professionals we ever saw were the nuns. And I loved them. I thought they were just profoundly interesting and delightful women in my life who took care of everything in the parish. They taught us and they looked after making sure that we were trying to help people that were worse off than we were, and we were sure there were nuns all over the world taking care of people, and they were running hospitals and orphanages. And the thing about these nuns is they never, ever showed any sign of having any interest in accumulating personal wealth. They all wore the same habits. They lived in convents and shared the same resources. And they never got paid. And we all had this role model. And I sometimes have to wonder, you know, about the immigrant Catholic Church in this country. Whatever happened to that role model? Whatever happened to that idealism that you could be a fulfilled and a happy adult and not be trying to accumulate personal wealth for yourself? And I call that a spirituality. I call the IRS my spiritual director. And that you can be stirred by a spirit of idealism and really try to live your life in accord with the values that you actually hold, and then feel like you've been gifted, graced with an unusually wonderful opportunity.
Nice. It seems like, in a lot of ways, the way that you, the things that you do in your life, it feels like to me, and this is just from the limited amount of reading I've done about what you've done, that it's almost as if you don't, there's really no decision about you taking the actions that you do. It seems like it's just something that you do, that you know that you just are supposed to. Is that accurate in a way?
Well, I guess I think that reflection happens not, if for me, not, you know, in years and years in advance of a particular decision, but rather quite often just by being in an alignment with people whom I've admired very, very much and seeing what they've done that makes it more plausible to take those kinds of steps myself. I'm thinking, for instance, that there are some elderly people who were very, very important in my life, almost like grandmothers and grandfathers. And they were people who were part of the civil rights movement, and they were part of those early lunch counter sit-ins and freedom rides. And then they were part of the anti-Vietnam War movement, and they had their own farming cooperative in a section of Gano, Ohio, near Cincinnati. I'm thinking of Ernest Bromley and Maurice McCracken, and I don't know anybody who didn't just simply love these characters, really intensely loved them and admired them. And when I first met them, I guess I thought, wow, I don't know if I could ever do what they do, but they certainly seemed to take it in stride. And probably in my view, when I was in my late 20s, I was in awe of them, but eventually it did seem to be a pretty normal and a natural thing for them to every year after Christmas head out to Washington, D.C. to be part of a civil disobedience action at the White House, or for them to so not cooperate with arresting authorities that the arresting authorities would pull them by their hair and use stun guns on them and handcuff them from behind. And I think, wow, where do they get that kind of courage? But this had been over the span of a lifetime, and you know, they'd be eating their strawberry pie at Fritch's, which is a you know, like a pie making chain in Cincinnati, and the state's troopers would come in and arrest them from the booth that these two dear old men were sitting in. And eventually, I think they kind of won over many of the people in Cincinnati who might have been hostile toward them, people who didn't like that they were integrating the community as best they could, or people who didn't like it that they didn't want to pay for war, that they were challenging this big nuclear power plant. I think eventually people began to see Maurice and Ernest as people that they were very glad to have in their community, that they were very touched and moved by. And I think that's kind of how it works, you know. Eventually, onlookers are persuaded, they're sort of won over to think, well, these people's values maybe aren't so bad. I think right now, if anyone gets a chance to go to www.electronicirock.net and read Tom Fox's diaries, they're somewhat edited by a very skillful editor, Jeff Gunsel, who understood, I think, what Tom Fox was about quite well. Jeff had been to Iraq many times himself. And when you get a chance to read what Tom Fox was saying about what he saw as the most logical step ahead for him, he knew that Margaret Hassan had been murdered in Iraq. He understood the risks, but he said that she lived a life she lived extravagantly on behalf of others, and she wouldn't allow gates to separate her from people in Iraq whom she'd grown to know and love, and he aspired toward that himself. So it's, you know, thinking of Tom Fox's murder, I know it seems like, well, here's this person who's inscrutably in another realm, you know, that he would go over to Iraq and he'd stay there and he'd take that risk, and now there's, of course, three others that we hope would be released, but maybe they won't be. But when you think about, you know, people who were deeply affected by Jesus. Jesus didn't die of old age, and all but one of the apostles were executed, and most of them went to prison. So it's to be expected to some extent that empires and occupying authorities, Jesus and the disciples lived under occupation, empires and authorities are not going to go for the idea that you love your enemies and you pray for those who persecute you and you share your belongings and you don't have some having more than others. But I believe that those are principles that have survived an awful long time, you know, and I'd like to see them keep surviving.
It's so nice. I would consider myself someone who's been suspect of Christianity in a lot of ways because of the outspoken Christians that I see, and although I've done some sort of investigation on my own about what Christianity is all about, and I find myself seeing so many of the people who I thought were what all Christians were, saying things that seemed contradictory to what I understood Christianity to be. It's talking to you and reading about your life, it's been really refreshing, and really it's nice to see someone who believes in what you believe in also doing the things you do and really trying to follow the teachings of the Bible and of Jesus. So,
you know, a person that I think is really a fine exemplar for our time is Archbishop Romero. In El Salvador, he really was somebody who loved his books. He loved to be in a comfortable library. He had no intention of ever becoming somebody who would be a champion of the poor and risk his life on their behalf by going up against death squads and people planning massacres and a very, very repressive and brutal military regime. But somehow, because I think the Vatican might have thought, well, let's appoint a guy who's not going to rock the boat, he was appointed archbishop in El Salvador. And then one of his close friends was killed by the military, a Jesuit priest named Rutilio Grande. And that began the conversion of Archbishop Romero, but even more so, he got to know the poor people that Rutilio Grande knew. And he started on a Saturday morning opening up his own parish, Archbishop Romero's parish, to poor people. And he'd say, you come here. You come and be on a radio show with me. Let's talk together to our country and try to make sense out of what's happening to us. And then he opened up a birthing center right there in the Archdiocesan Chancery office, and he constantly invited the poor people to come and be with him and talk to him about their concerns, and they'd be lined up and they'd be hanging off of him and they'd be inviting him to come to their celebrations, and he just couldn't walk away from them at that point. And so as he began to be more and more identified and aligned with the people who were, you know, getting their food out of garbage heaps and holding and cradling emaciated children and begging that they just simply be allowed to live and not be considered criminals because they were asking for very, very basic human rights. As he got to know those people, he became converted, and it was entirely clear he wasn't going to live long. You know, there were death threats, and he said in advance of being shot to death as he was celebrating a liturgy, he said, "Me they may kill, but my blood, it will rise in the Salvadoran people." And I honestly don't think you can kill the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Mohandas Gandhi, Archbishop Romero, Tom Fox, Margaret Hassan. What they have stood for is just simply not going to be erased, or that slate won't be wiped off, because people do have ideals, and they will look to those people. I watched a film about Romero with some Colorado Springs College students last week, and they were clearly very, very, very moved, and they were saying, "We didn't know this history, but we'd like to learn about this." And that's the kind of history, you know, Franz Jägerstätter, I don't think he ever thought when he asserted he wasn't going to join Hitler's armies that some school teacher in Chicago in the United States, you know, 4 decades later was going to be teaching every student she ever encountered who Franz Jägerstätter was. But these sparks kind of get passed on. Actually, you know, Tolstoy had a big influence on Gandhi, and Gandhi had a big influence on the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, and he in turn had a big influence on Romero. These sparks get transferred, and you just don't know. You know, who expected Cindy Sheehan to come around the corner and be in a drainage ditch and become somebody who revived peace movements in many areas? But I also want to say, I hope this won't be totally contradictory, that I think the feminists were right in the 60s when they said the only stars are in the firmament. What's needed are not stars so much as people who will take upon themselves the enjoyment of some of that hard work of knocking on doors and approaching their coworkers, talking over a cup of coffee, but also starting to organize the efforts that would communicate to elected representatives and to media and to wider and wider groups of people. We want to put an end to something. And I sometimes imagine, what if you could stand in the middle of the Vietnam Wall Memorial and say to yourself, "That's the end. You know, it had ended because I stepped up to the plate and started organizing to end that war earlier." I went through the Vietnam War, a bit like Brigadoon in the Mist. I was in college, and, you know, I didn't step up to the plate. I knew some people on my campus who were organizing, and I wrote papers about the Vietnam War. But it was still going on, and I didn't ever become involved. I even looked at the ones who did get involved with some askance and thought, don't they have something better to do? I feel very, very badly about that. I wasn't one of the people who tried to make that war end sooner, and it could have ended sooner. And because it didn't, you know, there were 2 million Vietnamese people killed and 50,000 U.S. troops came home in body bags. And many of the Vietnam veterans that we meet now are still struggling with the after effects of that war. So here we are at war now. You know, when you talk to these vets that come back, and some are fine, they're going to feel proud about what they did, but there are many that aren't fine. I'm sorry, they're just not. They're coming back shaken and weakened and uncertain and anxious. So, you know, could we end this war sooner, or is it going to drag on and on and on? That's a big question for us to face, I think.
Do you believe that it has? Well, I guess I'm asking an obvious question. Do you believe that it depends on us, the people who have the power to talk to our politicians and write and do like you said to spread that, to pass that spark along, no matter even how small it may seem to be inside of us. You know that.
Well, I'm really glad that you phrased that the way you did, Michael. You said depends on us, the people who have the power to write, because, I mean, right now, I can tell you honestly that I, on two occasions, made calls to people in Baghdad, and the person at the other end was so afraid because a Westerner was talking on a cell phone to him that he said, I'm sorry, I can't talk to you right now, and the call was cut within a minute. Now, there are other people who've called me and somehow have felt a greater liberty to speak, but can you imagine how frightened people are right now to speak up and say anything in Iraq? Now, here in this country, we don't face anything close to the risks that people face in other countries if they try to say anything about a political situation. Now, some of your listeners might say, well, then isn't Kathy Kelly then just telling us that we have to be in there to protect people in Iraq? But the argument that I'm persuaded by says that the United States presence in Iraq right now is the destabilizing force that's fueling ongoing insurgency, that in some ways we're creating terrorists faster than we can kill them, and that it's a much more sensible and sane gamble that we could put the money we're putting into the military into a protective presence composed of a multinational representation of peacekeepers that the United Nations would have to put together. They're basically the only referees on the bench. But going back to that point of the power that we have, you know, we do live in a democracy. The risks are not that great to call or to write your elected representative. And the risks aren't that great, really, to be involved in a demonstration or possibly even in a civil disobedience action. We don't face those death squads that the people in El Salvador faced off with. But I think the risk of not becoming politically engaged and socially active on an issue that you care deeply about is a great risk, really, because if we don't have those socially engaged activists to try to challenge the people who are already invested in weapon systems, these weapon systems that we have can end life on Earth as we know it.
Wow. That's a lot to think about.
Well, let me say one other thing then, Michael. I think if you spread the peanut butter too thin, the bread rips. You know, it's well and good for people to say, well, that Kathy Kelly, she sure talks about a lot of different issues. But the most important thing, if you become socially active, I think, is to really find the issue that you believe is the one that gives you a great deal of passion, and you want to study that issue and know that issue thoroughly. And maybe it would be about ways to better distribute locally grown organic foods. Maybe it would be about ways to cut back on consumption of fossil fuels. Maybe it would be about resisting the war in Iraq. Or maybe somebody says, hey, I really want to better understand what's happening in Iran. Or perhaps somebody else would say, I think this war in Colombia is wrongful and I'm going to get a better grip on what's happening there. Or maybe it's very, very local, you know, seeing homelessness or seeing that there are cutbacks in terms of education standards or health care. But to know an issue passionately and know it well and be willing to make that issue part of the everyday fabric of your life, that's the kind of thing that I think can help unhinge that pendulum that's kind of stuck up there that really ought to be swinging toward reform. But I think some very clever think tankers, people who are paid millions of dollars to work for think tanks, have figured out how to keep it up there and to keep supporting the ruling elites in this country today. And those ruling elites have a great deal to do with defense spending and war making.
Wow. it's funny. Like one of the things that's happened with me with doing this podcasting and getting involved with more grassroots sort of media has been that I've been completely with my head in the sand about world events and the America's role in them. That a lot of times I have that moment of like just wow, and no response. But it's just it's good to hear you say to talk about. I think a lot of times I feel like I need to like get involved in everything and know about everything that's going on, and it's not possible.
No, it's not possible. And the other thing is, if you wait until you're perfect to take action, you'll wait an awful long time.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like if people say, well, maybe you're doing this because of, you know, your own insecurities, or maybe you're trying to compensate for something that was lacking in your upbringing, or maybe you're lonely and you don't have another way to make friends. Well, maybe. But I don't think we ever, any of us, operate on pure, sheer non-ego-related values. We all have egos. It's the way that the psyche is constituted, and I don't think we can ever say that you know we're not getting anything out of this for ourselves. Sure, people do get something for themselves when they become socially active. They might feel like they're more meaningful in their, you know, presence on earth. They might feel like their work can have more benefits to a wider group of people, and they feel better about themselves. And I think that's okay. But sometimes you really face some big decisions about inherent flaws in your work. You know, that you, some will say, well, that's your privilege because you were born into a more well-endowed class in society, or because, you know, you're part of a white race that can, well, you know, afford to go to prison for 3 years or for 1 year, and you'll still get a job when you go out. But if that were to happen to somebody who's African American or Hispanic or Asian, they might find that they're never going to be able to put their lives back together after release, and so that might be referred to as white privilege. And I think that's a very, very serious thing to think about. I don't mean to be dismissive when I say, you know, we're not perfect. Or when we went over to Iraq, we were taking visas from a dictatorship, and that wasn't a perfect thing to do. We couldn't go and stand in front of Saddam's palace and start to demonstrate. We would have gravely endangered other people that helped us when we went to their homes and sat down and tried to learn from them. We would have gravely endangered anybody who signed those visas in the first place if we had done a demonstration in front of Saddam's palace. So, yeah, there was a flaw. We couldn't be fully engaged in nonviolent direct action as we would have wanted to be to tell the truth about what was happening in Iraq as well. So I think you have to acknowledge that and really strive to put together the most airtight argument that you can on behalf of taking an action that you take. But sometimes you just can't get that value of perfection as an ingredient.
Right. Well, thanks for... Oh, go ahead.
Well, I think, however, that, you know, the situations can be so dire that it is appropriate to try for the further invention of nonviolence, hampered mm-hmm. as we may be by limitations that we face.
Well, yeah, that's another one of those moments that I'm thinking, okay, what do I do with this information? But it's good. It's good for me, and I think it's good for a lot of people who may not have thought about a lot of these things that you're, like, living. So.
Well, could I recommend a book? It's kind of hard to find,
yes.
But it's called From Yale to Jail by Dave Dellinger. And I think he's one of the finest men that ever walked this planet. He was someone who, you know, could have had, after his experiences at Yale, a very good career, and he was much beloved by his professors, by his fellow students, just a real intact, fine person, very attractive in many, many, many ways. And he decided that he was going to really commit himself to this, as I say, further invention of nonviolence. And he was one of the speechwriters, for instance, for the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. He was right in there with the nonviolent anti-war efforts during the Vietnam War. He traveled extensively, went to Saigon during the war when the bombs were falling. And he always wrote so helpfully about his experiences. His reflections were just extremely valuable. And to get to know his life story, he died recently. His widow, Elizabeth Peterson, is still in touch with some of us, and she was very much a part of why he was able to do what he did, because she was his mentor, and in many ways they never developed a project until they both could kind of sign off on it. But anyway, I would really recommend trying to find that book, From Yale to Jail by David Dellinger. University libraries certainly should have it.
Okay. I just wrote it down.
Good. Here, I get this pulpit. Thank you very much.
Well, I should start wrapping it
pulpit.
Up.
Yeah, I'm doing like
but that's what I love about the podcast thing, because it's really just whatever it is. So
no one's going to fire you, is what you're telling me.
Exactly. Yeah, and I think that it's because it's so unrestricted, it can be, you know. What imperfect, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And well, that's an exciting new technology. I recently did the Christian Peacemaker Team 1 month long training, because I'll be going over to Iraq April 3rd, and I want to go over with them. They're the only group operating outside the green zone. And part of the training was to put inside of a mini camera, you know, video cam, new tapes and batteries, and do it while you're running down the street and filming license plates. I understand this technology very well, but when we get into our discomfort zones, that may be when some of the best learning takes place. So I'll keep practicing with that video cam and be very glad that you're learning this new technology as well. I want to thank
Perfect.
You very much, Michael, and wish you the very best.
Thank you. The same to you. Thank you so much for taking the time and your patience with my getting cut off
sure.
with the computer.
And if
All
people
right,
want
well,
to get in touch with us, my email is Kathy, K-A-T-H-Y, at vcnv.org. That's Voices for Creative Nonviolence. And we have a website, www.vcnv.org. And let me just remind people that might be interested in Tom Fox's writing, a good place to explore that is at www.electronicirock.net, and certainly to go to the CPT website as well.
Okay.
Okay, very
good. I'll put all of that information on my website as well, so people can find it easily.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so
Take
much.
Care now.
Thank you. All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that concludes the interview with Kathy Kelly. Thank you again, Kathy, for being on the show. I'm going to end the show here. After we hear from Bicycle Mark, who you can find, of course, at bicyclemark.com. He has done a segment for my show, Activism 101, that's been on hiatus for a while, but we may be getting one soon, as we will be. I'm sitting on, actually, a 100-word story from Lawrence Simon. So I'll make sure that that gets in the show next week, when we will have David Rovics as the guest. And that's all. The Activism 101 on David. Oh, my God. I try so hard to be smooth. Dave Dillinger is who Kathy Kelly just mentioned. And I think my pal Jake in Brooklyn, who I got to meet actually a couple weekends ago, was big on Dave Dillinger as well. Anyway, why don't I shut up? Here is Activism 101, the very first installment, and that is the end of the show. Thanks for listening, guys.
Hello, Mikey and Mikey Pod on the Bayou listeners. This is Bicycle Mark, pod journalist here in Amsterdam, with a first installment of the series that we're going to call Activism 101. This is the series where I come on and tell you a little fun fact of information, a little background as to situations that are going on in the world. Today, for our first installment, I wanted to talk about something related to the peace movement, especially considering all the conflict in the world, both involving the United States and just involving other nations in general. I thought I would talk about one of my most favorite activists from the Vietnam War era, and that is David Dellinger. Now, David Dellinger was a member of the famous Chicago 8, often called the Chicago 7, but really it was 8, which included members such as Bobby Seale and Abby Hoffman, and they became famous when they led the protest outside the Democratic National Convention in 68. And they were outspoken critics of war and pacifists and nonviolent resistors.
Our position is that whoever the candidates are and whatever the platforms, that we must stay in the streets and stay in active resistance, or else there will be no peace, either in the ghettos or in Vietnam.
Now, Dellinger himself did serve time in prison, often for his activist ways. And while in prison, he was actually a great leader of prisoner rights movements, the right of prisoners to have certain things and to be able to do certain things and to exist, right? Dellinger marched with me, or better phrased, I marched with him, when he was 75 years old, just before his death, well, a few years, in 2001 in Quebec City, against the Free Trade of America Agreement, FTAA, in Quebec City. And I didn't see him, but I knew he was there, and there were so many people that I couldn't find them. But I think in these times of war and making war and demonstration and all the activists out there, I think it's a good time to look back on David Dellinger and remember how he did things and maybe borrow a page from his notes, you know? And I think if he knew that I was doing such a little segment on a podcast, he would insist that he was nobody and that he shouldn't be martyred. And again, that's always a sign of greatness when you are modest. So I'm remembering David Dellinger today and hoping that some of his wisdom passes on to all of us activists out there today. Well, this has been the first installment of Activism 101, and let's see what happens next time. Hope you enjoyed, and see ya.
I want to ask you what has happened to a country whose political objectives must be secured at the end of a bayonet.